was the darkness evil? The third major argument used in support of the gap theory concerns the darkness of Genesis 1 verse 2. Since darkness is almost always used as a symbol of sin and judgment in the scriptures, John 3:19, Jude 13, etc., and since God did not say that the darkness was good, as he did concerning the light, Genesis 1 verse 4, proponents of the gap theory insist that God originally created the world in light, Psalm 104 verse 2, 1 Timothy 6:16, and only later plunged it into darkness because of the sin of angels and Satan. This again is an impressive argument, but all of the biblical evidences need to be taken into consideration. Psalm 104 verses 19 to 24, for example, makes it quite clear that physical darkness, the absence of visible light, is not to be considered as inherently evil or as the effect of divine judgment. Speaking of the wonders of the day-night cycle, the psalmist states, "The sun knoweth his going down. Thou makest darkness, and it is night, wherein all the beasts of the forest creep forth. The young lions roar after their prey and seek their food from God. O Jehovah, how manifold are thy works! In wisdom hast thou made them all. The earth is full of thy riches." If the making of darkness is a revelation of God's wisdom and riches, how can it be inherently evil? In discussing the opening verses of Genesis, Dr. Young points out the true significance of the term darkness. God gives a name to the darkness just as he does to the light. Both are therefore good and well-pleasing to him. Both are created, although the express creation of the darkness, as of other objects in verse 2, is not stated, and both serve his purpose of forming the day. Darkness is recognized in this chapter as a positive good for man. Whatever be the precise connotation of the evening of each day, it certainly included darkness, and that darkness was for man's good. At times, therefore, darkness may typify evil and death, and other times it is to be looked upon as a positive blessing. It would seem reasonable to assume that the reason why God did not see that the darkness was good is that darkness is not a specific entity or a thing, but it is rather an absence of something, namely light. Perhaps it is for this same reason that God did not say that the firmament, expanse, of the second creative day was good. It, too, was a rather negative entity, being the empty space between the upper and lower waters. The fact that the absence of light is not incompatible with the presence and blessing of God is evidenced by the statement that the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters in the midst of this primeval darkness. In the words of the psalmist, "Even the darkness hideth not from thee, but the night shineth as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to thee." Psalm 139, verse 12. How many creative acts in Genesis 1? The fourth major supporting argument for the gap theory is built upon a supposed distinction between the verbs created, barara, and made, asya. If this distinction is not clearly maintained, then the gap theory must collapse. For Exodus 20 verse 11 states that, "In 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is." Obviously, if God made everything within 6 days, there would be no room for a long time interval between the creating of the heavens and earth, Genesis 1:1, and the creating of all other things, Genesis 1 verses 2 to 31. Therefore, the gap theory requires that made, asa, in Exodus 20:11, should be understood as referring only to the refashioning of the heavens and earth in 6 days after the judgment of Genesis 1 verse 2. We are disappointed to find the outstanding New Scofield Reference Bible, 1967, supporting this distinction between created and made in Genesis 1. Only 3 creative acts of God are recorded in this chapter. 1. The heavens and the earth, verse 1. 2. Animal life, verses 20 and 21. And 3. Human life, verses 26 and 27. The first creative act refers to the dateless past. page 1 on the Scofield Bible, note number 4. With regard to Genesis 1 verse 3, "And God said, let there be light, and there was light," the New Scofield Reference Bible states that neither here nor in verses 14 through 18 is an original creative act implied. A different word is used. The sense is made to appear, made visible. The sun and moon were created in the beginning. The light came from the sun, of course, but the vapor diffused the light. Later the sun appeared in an unclouded sky. From the Scofield Bible, page 1, note number 6. But this interpretation raises serious questions. In the first place, if God had intended to convey to us the idea that the heavenly bodies, sun, moon, and stars, were already in existence on the first day, but only appeared on the fourth day by a removal of clouds, the verb to appear could easily have been used, as in Genesis 1 verse 9, "and let the dry land appear." Furthermore, if the sun was created in Genesis 1:1, how could the earth have been shrouded in total darkness in 1 verse 2? No cloud canopy could have excluded the sun's light, for water vapors were not elevated above the firmament until the second day of creation. Even more serious for the gap theory is the fact that Genesis 1 verse 21 states that God created the great sea monsters, while verse 25 states that God made the beasts of the earth. Surely we are not to think that sea creatures were directly created on the fifth day, but land animals were merely appointed or made to appear on the sixth day. All those who hold that Bera and ashes cannot be used of the same kind of divine activity are faced with a serious difficulty here. In fact, the difficulty is so severe that the New Scofield Reference Bible, in support of this distinction, suggests that the beasts which were made on the sixth day, verse 25, were actually already created on the fifth day. A quote on page 2, note number 2. But such an interpretation is impossible, since the beasts were obviously brought into existence for the first time on the sixth day. "Let the earth bring forth," verse 24. This bringing into existence is described as a work wherein God made the beast of the earth, verse 25. And what does the gap theory do about the plant kingdom, which was brought forth from the earth on the third day, verses 11 and 12? It must reject the idea that it was created on that day. It is by no means necessary to suppose that the life germ of seeds perished in the catastrophic judgment which overthrew the primitive order. With the restoration of dry land and the light, the earth would bring forth as described. A quote from the Old Scofield Reference Bible, page 4, note 3. But this is a very bizarre concept, especially when we realize how rich is God's use of synonyms for created in these passages. For example, he commands the waters to swarm with swarms of living creatures, verse 20. This is explained in the following verse to mean that God created every living creature that moveth wherewith the waters swarmed. Likewise, Genesis 2 verse 7 tells us that God formed man of the dust of the ground, which must mean created in the light of Genesis 1:27. Arthur Custance, in his recent book Without Form and Void, even attempts to draw a distinction between God's making us in his image and likeness, 1:26, and creating us in his image, chapter 1, verse 27. According to Origen, 3rd century A.D., he concludes that while both image and likeness were appointed, only the image itself was created by God, the achievement of the likeness being left as something to be wrought out by experience. Page 180. Thus, according to Dr. Custance, we were not created in the image and likeness of God. But if this be true, then God could hardly have made man in his likeness in the same day he created him, Genesis 5, verse 1. Also, we wonder how Adam could have begotten Seth in his own likeness, as well as after his image, chapter 5, verse 3. These examples should suffice to show the absurdities to which we are driven by making distinctions which God never intended to make. For the sake of variety and fullness of expression, a basic and extremely helpful characteristic of Hebrew literature, different verbs are used to convey the concept of supernatural creation. It is particularly clear that whatever shade of meaning the rather flexible verb made may bear in other contexts of the Old Testament. In the context of Genesis 1, it stands as a synonym for created. Thus, not only animal life and human life, but also plant life and the astronomic bodies were directly created by God in their appropriate days. And this fact, in the light of Exodus 20, verse 11, is utterly devastating to the gap theory. Other arguments. In addition to the four major arguments for the gap theory discussed above, one frequently hears the claim that the phrase "replenish the earth" in Genesis 1:28 implies that the earth was once filled, but now had to be filled again, replenished or refilled. But the verb in the Hebrew text, mela, simply means to fill, with no suggestion of a repetition. This has been acknowledged by Custance in his book Without Form and Void, page 8. Some writers claim that Hebrews 4, verse 3 should be translated, "The works were finished from the downfall of the world," linking this with the catastrophic interpretation of Genesis 1, verse 2. But this cannot be supported by context or usage of the word. See Hebrews 9, verse 26. See F.F. Bruce, The Epistle to the Hebrews, published by Erdmans, 1964, page 71. It is also frequently claimed that Ezekiel chapter 28, verses 13 and 14, demands an originally glorious world before the waste and void of Genesis 1, verse 2, for it speaks of Satan as dwelling in Eden, the garden of God, the holy mountain of God, and walking up and down in the midst of the stones of fire before his rebellion against God. But it seems clear from a comparison with Daniel 2:45 and Isaiah 14:13 that the holy mountain of God must refer to the third heaven of God's immediate presence and not to an earthly domain. It should be noted that Satan was cast out of the mountain of God to the ground. Ezekiel 28, verses 16 and 17. See also Isaiah 14, 12. Apparently, the Lord Jesus Christ spoke of this event when he said, "I beheld Satan fallen as lightning from heaven." Luke 10, 18. It should also be noted that Eden, the garden of God, was not a garden with trees, flowers, and streams. It was composed of precious stones and stones of fire. Ezekiel 28, verses 13, 14, and 16. When we compare this with the description of the holy city of Revelation 21, verses 10 to 21, with its various precious stones, we must conclude that Ezekiel's garden of God refers not to an earthly Eden back in Genesis 1:1, but to a heavenly one from which Satan was cast down to the earth. When God created the heavens at the beginning of the first day of creation week, he apparently created all the angelic beings, including the unfallen Satan, who were thus on hand to sing together and shout for joy at the creation of the earth. Job 38, verse 7. Sometime after creation week and before the temptation of Eve, Satan rebelled against his Creator. The visible earthly effect of his fall would thus not have been a catastrophe in Genesis 1:2, but the Edenic curse of Genesis 3, which God inflicted upon the entire earth because Adam and Eve, to whom God had given full dominion of the earth, chose to believe and obey Satan rather than God. Romans 8, verses 20 to 23. Conclusion. The gap theory continues to claim wide support in the evangelical Christian community because it offers rather impressive biblical support for a position that does not radically challenge the geologic timetable of modern historical geology. Nevertheless, this theory, on closer inspection, compromises the unity and completeness of the creation account, the original perfection of the world, the genetic continuity of fossil and living forms, the totality of Adam's dominion, and the uniqueness of both the Edenic curse and the global catastrophism of Noah's flood. We would agree with advocates of the gap theory that the earth has undergone a cataclysmic change as a result of divine judgment. The face of the earth bears everywhere the marks of such a catastrophe. A quote from the Old Schofield Reference Bible, page 3, note 3. However, we would identify this catastrophe with the universal flood of Noah, which not only occupies 3 entire chapters of Genesis, but also is referred to by David, Psalm 29, verse 10, Isaiah, chapter 54, verse 9, Christ, Matthew 24, verse 39, and Luke 17, 27, and Peter, 1 Peter 3, verse 20, and 2 Peter, chapter 2, verse 5, and chapter 3, verse 6. It was through the vast and complex current patterns of this year-long deluge that the living creatures of the entire world were buried and fossilized in enormous sedimentary strata that underlie every continent of the globe. It is this catastrophe that provides for us the God-given answer to the false uniformitarianism of these last days, 2 Peter 3, verse 4, and thus effectively foreshadows the final destruction of all things by fire at the climax of the day of the Lord. 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 7 to 13. The Canadian Rockies. Mountain ranges in our present world are vastly different from those before the flood. In the first place, they are as much as 4 times higher in elevation, some being over 28,000 feet above sea level. Such mountains could never have been covered by a global flood. However, if the earth were completely flat, only 10,000 feet of water would cover it. Secondly, they are packed with billions of fossils of plants and animals that were rapidly buried to great depths by the swirling waters of the Great Flood. Mountains before the flood had no fossils, for they were uplifted by God before living things were created. Genesis 1, verses 9 to 10, and verses 20 to 22. Thirdly, they are covered with snow and ice. Before the flood, the great vapor canopy, Genesis 1, verses 6 to 8, produced a greenhouse effect, trapping the reflection of solar heat, as on Venus today, and providing a warm climate even in the polar regions. The collapse of this vapor canopy during the early weeks of the flood, Genesis 7, verses 11 and 12, took the form of snow and ice in the higher latitudes, causing huge glaciers, the sudden freezing of mammoths and other creatures, and the locking up of enough water in the form of ice to expose land bridges from Asia to Alaska and Australia. This intense but comparatively brief ice age following the flood has been considerably modified in recent millennia, causing ocean levels to rise and many seamounts and land bridges to be drowned. The dinosaur. The dinosaurs, terrible lizards, flourished especially during the period from Adam to the flood because of the warm and humid climate that characterized the entire pre-flood world. They did not become extinct before Adam, for he was given dominion over all the kinds of animals, Genesis 1:28. This has been confirmed by the remarkable discovery of human footprints in the same rock layers with the footprints of dinosaurs. In the broader sense of the term dinosaur, we may say that they are not yet extinct. On the island of Komodo in Indonesia, about 1,000 huge dragon lizards still survive, some of them attaining a length of 10 feet and a weight of over 300 pounds. And surely the 20-foot crocodile would qualify as a terrible lizard. Since reptiles attain sexual maturity long before their full growth is reached, we need not assume that huge and therefore old individuals represented their kind on Noah's Ark. After the flood, reptilian dinosaurs found themselves confined to a comparatively narrow belt near the equator, and thus in most cases became extinct during the subsequent centuries of desperate struggle for existence against the more versatile and adaptable mammals. Summary. In total harmony with the methods he employed in bringing highly complex end products into existence suddenly during his brief public ministry on the earth, the Son of God created the earth as a dynamic, functioning, fully equipped home for man in a fantastically short period of time. The earth did not evolve from a chaos of gas and dust. Neither did it cool down from a molten mass of rock and metal. It was created by purely supernatural means during 6 literal days and completely furnished with all the basic kinds of living things that have ever existed, including man. Naturalistic alternatives to the God-revealed account of origins have been increasingly untenable in recent decades as our supply of knowledge in the earth and life sciences has reached staggering proportions. Astronomers, with all their amazing discoveries, have still failed to explain how the Earth, the Sun, the Moon, and the stars could have evolved into their present form by natural processes. Geologists and paleontologists have failed to explain how the huge fossil strata were laid down, how mountains arose from the sea, why dinosaurs became extinct, why all the missing links have disappeared, how the Ice Age began, and how enormous lava flows were poured out upon the Earth. Biologists and geneticists have failed to explain how life could have arisen spontaneously, how the DNA code was formed, why all living creatures reproduce after their kinds, and how the evolutionary hypothesis can survive the deadly formulas of the second law of thermodynamics. Anthropologists have conspicuously failed to bridge the yawning biocultural chasm that separates the lowest man from the highest animal. The Bible makes it clear that the early earth was an uncontaminated, highly ordered, and completely harmonious environment for the first human beings. Nature was in harmony with man because man was in harmony with his God. At first, no animals were carnivorous. It is true that plants and fruits were eaten and thus destroyed, and bacteria caused dead vegetable matter to decay, but no animal or human blood was shed through mutual destruction, and no natural catastrophes imperiled living things. Although the second law, entropy, was in operation, its harmful effects upon man's world were overbalanced by God's gracious control of all physical and biological systems. Similarly, overpopulation was no threat to the biosphere because God was over, not under, his own laws, and this is still true today. Reproductive rates in all living things were under his direction. All of this is, of course, impossible for the mind of man to grasp today through empirical science alone, apart from divine revelation. We are so immersed in a world that groans and travails in pain, Romans 8:22, because of the Edenic curse, Genesis 3, verses 16 to 19, that we cannot imagine what the originally perfect earth was like apart from God's explanations in the pages of his written word. Trapped in the pinchers of the first and second laws of thermodynamics and boxed within an apparently eternal uniformitarian system, we cannot really picture a genuine creation of things or a sudden reprogramming of living things to the bondage of corruption, or a supernaturally induced destruction and mass burial of things on a global scale. But this is basically our problem, not God's. He has not only provided for us fascinating and adequate hints of these primeval realities in nature itself, but has also given us a clear and self-authenticating account of his great acts of creation and judgment in the Holy Bible. Many there are, to be sure, who would insist that a comparatively recent earth would be a deception on the part of God. Such accusations are both blasphemous and unfair. If God has told us of his creative methods, the order of events in the creation of various entities, and the amount of time which elapsed between these creative acts, we have no one to blame but ourselves for our ignorance. Furthermore, if men were really fair-minded in such matters, they would look at the other side of the ledger of empirical facts, which not only permits, but demands a recent origin of physical and biological systems. Christians are deeply committed to the proposition that in every problem area, whether it be ultimate origins, ultimate destiny, or ultimate meanings and values and priorities, the God who has revealed himself supremely in the Lord Jesus Christ and his written word cannot lie and cannot finally disappoint those who put their full trust in him. The natural order does demand a creator, and the wonder of all wonders is that this great creator also came to earth to pay the full price of human sin and to make it possible for those who believe in him to experience the fullness of his eternal purpose in creation. With all of its perfections, the earthly earth was therefore only a foretaste of the new earth which God will someday create. Revelation 21, verse 1. This is the end of the book.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew."